Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a time of crisis, challenge, setback, a lot of Americans are quietly wondering what really comes next for this country, what the future holds, a comeback, a decline. We're not alone. The whole world is watching and wondering, including my two guests today, British historians and thinkers Simon Schama and Neil Ferguson. We'll get their perspective on rise and fall and America. This hour on Point, Schama, Ferguson, and the American future. We have two great historians and public thinkers with us today, both British, both longtime residents of the United States. Joining me from New York is Simon Schama, professor of history now at Columbia University. He's lived in the U.S. since 1980, an enormous academic figure here, and a top public intellectual in the U.K. and beyond. The Times of London calls him a genius of storytelling, and he is much more than that. His new book, out this week, is The American Future, A History. Simon Schama, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. What was that music? Dire Straits? That would be appropriate.
You can hear it with us every day. I forget who it is, but it's our theme.
Maybe The Who. We won't be fooled again. How's that?
Fortet, it's called. Look it up.
You don't know, do you? You're bluffing.
It's just my theme. No, they're whispering in my ear. Also with us from New York, Neil Ferguson, professor of history at Harvard University and a professor at Harvard Business School. He moved to the U.S. in 2002. And with his big books, Empire, Colossus, and The War of the World, has become a major voice in public policy, history, and current economic debate. His latest book is The Ascent of Money. He's working on a big biography of Henry Kissinger. Neil Ferguson, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you both here.
Hello, Tom. It's nice to be here. I hear I'm not a genius. That's crushing.
Sorry. Okay.
That's a bad start.
Genius, you too. You can both have it. We're delighted to have you.
You find geniuses every day in the Apple service store anyway. Who needs one now?
It's a world of genius, and thank heavens for it. Maybe we need it. Simon Schama, do you really love America? Is that right?
Yeah, for God's sake, you know, I'm a fan of the Red Sox. How much more do you have to do to love America than that, for God's sake? Yeah, no, I do. I tell you why, actually, again, self-interestedly, America, I bet Neil feels the same way, gave me a sort of intellectual freedom that I didn't feel I quite had when I was teaching in British universities a long time ago. When I got to the university Neil now teaches at, someone said to me a question that still stuns me. What is it you would like to teach? That's actually... No one ever says that in Britain. You teach the immemorial wisdoms. You repeat that. And so this sense, actually, of opportunity... I do sound like a 19th century Chamber of Economists person, but I've always been grateful for that.
Does that love mean we're on the right track? You write in an epilogue to your book, The American Future, you say it's impossible for any attentive historian not to notice the proliferation of multiple crises, sort of looking suspiciously like a classic pre-revolutionary moment. We've seen this before, 18th century France, 20th century Russia. 21st century
USA?
Yeah,
well, I mean, you're casting us, I think, actually, Neil and I, as, you know, Pollyanna versus Chicken Little, but I suspect, like, often before
we're just getting started.
Our lines cross.
Yes.
because, actually, there's plenty of Chicken Little in me, and I do, it's certainly the case, as I'm sure you know as well, and our listeners out there know, that there's nothing to do you in, like an overextended foreign policy, wars coming at you without you quite intending them. Not quite figuring out the ways you're going to pay for them, saddling yourself with debt service charges that you can't quite figure out how to amortize over the years. And that classically has been what's done empires in a lot of the time. And we may be heading for that kind of thing. What distinguishes us, I think, actually, from the fate suffered by, say, Imperial Russia or pre-revolutionary France is that we are a vigorous working democracy, as the last election just proved. Doesn't necessarily mean to say the new government will come up with perfect solutions any more than the old, but it does mean that you have in an open and free forum the opportunity to face the magnitude of problems honestly and clearly. And I would give the present administration not bad marks, say a B+, on that score. That is an enormous source of strength, that nations that are doomed to perish because not realizing the alarming quality of the pratfalls in front of them. They simply sort of fell into them, and the entire body politic fell apart.
There's a lot of layers and nuance you want to get into here. Yeah, I'm starting out with a little Pollyanna versus Chicken Little, but we will get beyond it. Neil Ferguson, what about just this point? Simon Sharma looks at the United States, sees a vigorous working democracy, and says right there, you know, here's what will save us. You've been pretty gloomy in some settings in your prognosis for this country. What about it?
Well, I'm from Scotland, so it's my default setting to be gloomy.
All right.
My gloom when I published a book called Colossus, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire, was a little different from the traditional gloom that British historians purvey in the United States. After all, it was our countryman Paul Kennedy who predicted the decline of the American Empire in 1987,
yes,
2 years before the Soviet Union imploded, rather,
right, and we boomed,
confounding his predictions. And I think one has to be very careful not to assume that America's problems have to do with overseas commitments, imperial overstretch, to use Paul's famous phrase. It turns out, by rich irony, that the problems, the financial problems of the United States, are far more internal than they are external, and the costs of the unfunded liabilities of Medicare and Social Security vastly exceed the costs of the war in Iraq, or indeed the war in Afghanistan. Who would have predicted in the mid-2000s that it would be the American financial system that almost self-destructed in 2007-2008? So I've said for some time that America's problems are more internal than they are external, and they do have to do with public finance, and that's intimately connected with a problem in the political system. Yes, it's true that the election last year was a tremendous cathartic moment, and I shared Simon's euphoria the morning after Barack Obama's election, but it didn't really change the fact that there is something rotten at the heart of the legislative system, and that is the very overt corruption of the U.S. Congress. It's hard to understand this financial crisis if you don't recognize the extent to which financial institutions were able to buy sloppy oversight and poor regulation through campaign contributions and lobbying. And I think the crisis that's currently going on in the British Parliament will quite soon have an echo in the United States as disillusionment, not with the executive, but with the legislative branch grows in the electorate.
So do you contest then the notion that the U.S. facing a time of crisis right now has a vigorous working democracy?
I do contest that. I think there's something deeply unhealthy about American democracy, but it's not what meets the eye. You have to drill down and look at the financing of the electoral system to see what is rotten at the heart of the United States. You have to ask yourself, you know, who were the biggest recipients of campaign contributions from AIG, the insolvent insurer? The answer is the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And there's something very suspect about that. My big worry about the administration is that for all the charisma and indeed intelligence of the president and the people around the president, the legislature is actually in control. Congress was in control, for example, of the design of the stimulus bill, which was pork barrel politics at its worst and unlikely, in my view, to deliver much in the way of economic recovery. So there is a problem here, and I don't think it's gone away. Talk of green shoots of recovery seems to me to be premature, precisely because there are fundamental flaws in the way the financial system is regulated by Congress.
There you have the Presbyterian dominee, as is actually most
the gloomy
thunderously
Scott.
Gloomy. My friend's eyebrows are drooping.
Oh dear.
In a sort of full
lift him off
way,
the table.
As we speak. Oh, for God's sake. Give me a break. I mean, you don't expect politicians, let alone the Congress, I think, actually, to be kind of saints of purity. And what is the alternative? The alternative is some sort of, you know, committee of oversight of wise men drawn from Wall Street. Would that be a fantastic, you know, would that admit a better way in which to sort of run the bailout response? Look, I think actually in terms of they're not perfect. But one great thing is if indeed, you know, you actually think that it's sort of a kind of neo-Hanoverian corrupt conspiracy, which really brought us down last October. One way we do have in the United States is the route of congressional inquiry. If congressional inquiry can look at something like Abu Ghraib or, you know, other moments of infamy, could certainly do that. But if we take sort of, you know, smaller moments of pragmatic, concrete action, like the credit card restriction bill the other day, however many dirty fingers, even in terms of collective self-interest of this Congress, that was actually a fairly bipartisan moment where on the president's initiative or on Timothy Geithner's initiative, whoever's, it was decided to actually require that these sort of nefariously small print conditions on the back of one's credit card agreements didn't allow for piratical usury and compound the already appalling system of debt. Now, why was it bipartisan? Mm. Because which Republican, however, you know, grandiose in their adoration of the free market system, was actually going to say, fine, let the credit card companies charge 30% interest? Of course, they're not. So you are very revolutionary. So you want really a sweeping aside of the predictable imperfections of the legislative system. I would rather specific practical accomplishments were made by the imperfect.
Look, I'm a 19th century Gladstonian liberal, and when I look at the United States, I see a rich irony, which is that it has turned into what it revolted against in 1776. It's become old corruption in politics and red coats overseas, and there is an irony in that, that the United States has in a sense morphed into a kind of a Georgian England.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with two great British historians and thinkers about the American future. They join us from New York, Simon Schama, author of The American Future, A History. He's been writing out on the road much of it last year during the campaign season and looking back at American history as he looks ahead. Also joining us from New York, Neil Ferguson, in the same studio, professor at Harvard and Harvard Business School, author of The Ascent of Money and Colossus and Empire. And we're welcoming a little British perspective in this hour. We've got callers as well. Let's go right to one in Williamsburg, Virginia. Old colonial Williamsburg sits in everybody's mind as an image of the beginning. Martin joins us. Martin, what do you think today?
Hello. Yes. I'm from Williamsburg, one of our cradles of freedom. You can talk about the details. Societies have always gone up and down. There's always been the rise and fall of empire, and there are these cycles. You can trace them back for years.
That may be all we get from... are you there, Martin? So where do you see us headed now?
Yeah, okay. So these cycles, I believe that they're just human nature. There's 2.5 generations as people initially go through these hardships every 50 to 60 years. The virtues are refined out. The good has to prevail, because without it, they're going to sink even further. Their children have these virtues. They become gradually spoiled. They're piggybacking on their parents. And then by the next generation, they're spoiled. They've forgotten where they got it. The virtues that are there.
Martin, take us to your bottom line. Are we doomed or going to rise again?
No. I don't think we're doomed. The bottom line is that it is all a question of your morality. A democracy, here's where you started. A democracy is only as good, or a capitalist system, only as good as the morality of the people that make up that society. And our founders had an assumption that they had a basically moral society. And so they could license freedom. They could let people be on their own.
And now, Martin, take us to it. Take us to it, my friend. Take us to it.
Okay, if people can't be trusted, they have to be controlled. And control is always retrospective. It's always costly. And it comes right off the bottom line. And unfortunately, we're at one of these cycles right now. We're right where we're in trouble.
Right in trouble. We'll pick it up straight from there. Simon Schama, there's a very authentic voice right out of Williamsburg, Virginia. How do you respond? Rise and fall, morality is the basis for everything. We're in trouble now, says Martin.
Well, I think the great glory of American history, particularly in the generation of fathers, was that one man's morality, let's say Jefferson's, was another man's blasphemy, let's say Hamilton. Hamilton may have been the more morally imperfect figure, but arguably Hamilton may have had a more pragmatically or realistic view of what America had to be in order to endure as a free republic, a rather big government embrace of America's commercial and imperial destiny. It was Jefferson who, you know, sounded very moral about a nation of virtuous farmers being the only real democratic citizens, but of course Jefferson could say that because he had people of African-American race doing all the heavy lifting out there in Monticello. So, you know, morality has always been part of the American mix since the Pilgrim Fathers, since the Mayflower. There's no doubt about that. But it doesn't get us really very far, I think, actually. The important thing is actually that... the present president, the 44th president, wanted, what everyone thinks about it and has said so many times, to reestablish America as a kind of moral community. He's a serious Christian, but what he means by a moral community, as I understand him, is a sense of recovering those bits in American history which are there and are very rich and fertile and potent, which are about mutual concern, which were about, he often quoted scripture, do unto others as you would be done by, that out there in the precedent of Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt was one model of American concern for your neighbor, which didn't necessarily make you some form of faggoty crypto-European socialist. It made you as authentically American as the most rugged individualist. And, you know, he's thinking of church bake sales. He's thinking, really, of all the voluntarism in American society. He's thinking of those moments in American history where we looked out for each other. And whether or not that's sort of sentimental pie in the sky, it is, in my view, as authentically a part of American history and one we need to draw on now as the sense that basically we're just looking out for ourselves and our immediate family.
And a moral call in itself, Neil?
Well, I was going to say, Tom, I actually rather like Martin's point about generational cycles and the tendency for each generation to succeed the other and to change, in a sense, its morality. You go from the great generation that fought in World War II to the baby boomers, and if the great generation saved and fought, the baby boomers essentially borrowed and dodged the draft. The generation that has inherited their legacy, which I think in many ways President Obama personifies, has a huge problem on its hands, however, because each generation is different in size. The great fiscal problems that we were talking about earlier have an awful lot to do with that. There will be a lot of retired baby boomers very soon expecting to collect on Social Security and Medicare. And Generation X, or whatever you care to call it, the generation that's inheriting from them, isn't really going to be large enough, nor in fact well off enough, to pay the costs of the baby boomers' earlier profligacy. So the generational story is hugely important, but it's not just about morality. I'm afraid it is also about the costs and benefits of a very bloated and inefficient American welfare state.
But there's notions of time and inevitability embedded in Martin's observation as well. I mean, you know, Edward Gibbon wrote the book, A Decline and Fall. Rise and Fall is the phrase everybody uses. Do you see inevitability here? Are we in a time when it can be, you know, we can get around that rise and fall once again?
I would say the problem of theories of empire that are cyclical, that imply some kind of predictable trajectory, is that they really don't correspond to reality. Gibbon's account of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire covers about 1,000 years. Wow. Now, any empire that takes that long to decline has reason to celebrate. Think how quickly the Soviet Union declined. So it's not a rhythmical process in the way that demographics have a rhythm to them. Empires sometimes fall off cliffs without warning, and other times they dwindle away over millennia.
I'd also want to say, actually, Tom, if I may, I'd also want to say I think we're too sort of hung up on sort of bipolar view of history. It always has to be decline or fall or prospering and prosperity and omnipotence, white hats and black hats. What America clearly has to do, or what America is doing, whether it wants to or not, is change. It's more an evolutionary story than, I think, a revolutionary story. And there's no doubt that one of the most dreaded words in the American vocabulary, the L word, as in limits, limits to what you can do exactly in the context that Neil's just mentioned, but also limits of the kind of figure that America can present in the world generally, have to be better understood and accepted by the American people while not forfeiting their sense of the distinctiveness of what it means to be part of an American democracy. To actually persuade Americans that there is a way ahead that's distinctively American, but not simply profligate, again, we're very Presbyterian here this morning.
Yes.
We'll take a great tutor, we'll take a great headmaster, but my God, if you listen to the inaugural address, was there any speech more headmasterly than that?
Sort of get serious here
Well, put away childish things was the phrase, wasn't it, from Scripture, which almost began the speech. And thereafter followed, the enemy of that speech was smiley-faced America, was Ronald Reagan's shining City and Hill. By the way, City and Hill, of course, was a rather gloomy Calvinist remark made by Governor Winthrop, into which Ronald Reagan inserted shining. And there followed a view of American history, which was actually about adversity. It was about ordeals that Americans had gone through, suffering in steerage, suffering under the plantation overseer's lash. And it was a sort of, it was an appeal to grow up and to realize, in order to be, to stay the same, in order to be essentially American, we have to really adjust to a different world.
But there were also echoes of FDR's inaugural in 1933. After all, we can't ignore the fact that this president, which he certainly didn't expect, has inherited the biggest financial crisis since the early 1930s. And that so dominates the agenda that one almost forgets what the election campaign was about. The financial crisis was the deus ex machina that I think propelled him into the White House. But it's also completely taken over his presidency so far.
What about, not the Roman example, but yours? I mean, Americans look around, you know, we revolted against the British Empire. Great Britain saw it rise and rise and rise and then fall, and has looked, it looked pretty humble for a long time. I think it makes a lot of Americans wonder, you know, is that the distinctive new America, the sort of Britain of post-empire times, or is that an irrelevant model? Simon.
I actually think it is relevant. I not to try and come back at Neil's point. There's no denying the enormous magnitude of the entitlement catastrophe lying ahead of us. But I would go back a bit to our mutual friend Kennedy's view of overstretch. There's no doubt that actually the cost of two wars, First World War and the Second World War, did create a sort of serious sense of curtailment about what British sovereignty was capable of in terms of its far-flung empire. Maybe the Japanese invasions in East Asia did it for it. But there was no question that Britain really couldn't afford, even if it had wished to hang on to its imperial responsibilities after the Second World War. Now, I'm not saying, you know, America's faced with the same magnitude of a dilemma, but Neil may well say, oh, you know, the fiscal dilemma at home actually may shrink into triviality, the cost of the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we've only just started this war in Afghanistan. It's one which we're going to be more deeply committed to, especially if West Pakistan really basically becomes a failed state. So I'd say that those issues will be serious. They're not quite the same as the issues that Britain faced after the Second World War. Parody the beginning opening of Anna Karenina, you know, each empire disintegrates in its own particular way.
Neil, what about it? You've been dismissive of the Keynesian comeback of the 1930s as the parallel. You've sort of had open warfare a little bit with Paul Krugman there, said, you know, this isn't Keynes and 30s. This is, I don't know, if you want a Soviet model, fine, I'm quoting you saying there. What about, how humbled by our current financial straits are you imagining the United States down the road? Or could it be the pillars of a turnaround?
Well, I think that the parallel with Keynes isn't terribly helpful because the orders of magnitude are so different. The deficit this year will be nearly 13% of gross domestic product. That's not a 1930s-style deficit. That's an early 1940s deficit. The deficit was about that size in 1942, the
wartime
year after Pearl Harbor. And the debt burden is zooming upwards. The public debt to GDP ratio will be over 100% very soon, sooner, I think, than the administration forecasts. And the problem is that while Paul Krugman confidently expects this to generate recovery because he read the general theory when he was an undergraduate. The general theory was written in 1936, and the world is very different today. It's unclear to me that Keynesian measures will work. In fact, there's a high probability that all this borrowing will actually start pushing interest rates up, which makes the task of the Federal Reserve extremely difficult, using monetary policy to try and bring about recovery. So I remain skeptical about the notion that we're going to bounce back as rapidly as the administration said in its budget forecast. forecasts. But these imperial questions are helpful if you set them in some kind of comparative perspective. The reason Britain declined was not simply because of excessive debt and slow growth. It was because another empire was rising. Mm. And that's really the critical point. Power is relative. And one of the fascinating things about this financial crisis is that, bad though it is, it's turned out to be a lot worse for the European Union and a lot worse for most of East Asia, especially Japan. The exception to the rule seems to be China. If China's growth rate continues on something like a projected trend line, its gross domestic product will equal that of the United States as soon as 2027. Mm. And that's really the critical story. It's not really a problem for the United States if there's no rival, but there is now a rival. And the speed with which China is transforming itself, the rate of growth that they're attaining, and increasingly the strategic implications of that for Asia Pacific and beyond, these are the things that really interest me, because it's relative power you have to worry about. And I see the relative power of the United States suddenly dwindling very fast indeed.
Simon Chamat, vigorous working democracy, your phrase, in a good thing, meets massive American debt with China on the side. How do you look at that formula?
Well, I don't think that's right. I think Neil very uncharacteristically is a curiously inelastic view there of imperial competition. In other words, that it's a sort of zero-sum game, that we're in sort of, you know, beam balance, really, China up, America down. But, yeah, that's not the reality of the situation. China is indeed still growing at 2 to 3% or so, but...
6 to 7%, actually.
Oh, they've revised it down, they revised it.
No, the projections are at least 6% this year, and they may well exceed them, because they're...
Who makes the projections? The Central Committee of the Communist Party?
Yeah, the IMF, actually.
IMF,
same thing. Somewhere in there. Bigger than ours at the moment.
Same thing. All right. Yes. No. Granted, I'm not actually disputing that. You know, the Chinese future, as it were. But let's see what the implications are. First of all, I don't think the Chinese future necessarily represents a sort of security threat. That wasn't what Neil was invoking. But what people in China told me, and you know, Neil is the economic historian. I'm not. So, but what they you'd expect them to be in big gloat mode at the moment, mm. sort of, you know, Schadenfreude East, really. But that's not what you hear. That's not what you hear. Because
we
actually,
heard some in Shanghai not so long ago. I have heard some of that out of China.
You have heard Schadenfreude. Yeah, yeah. Well, what I heard was you know, whether or not they're disingenuous were professions, at least, mm-hmm. of not wanting the American model to fail, because the American model, they say, they invoke, even though their state capitalism is rather different from our own model, what they've been following for a long time. But it's mm-hmm. not just a matter of saving face. Mm-hmm. Let's take, you know, the famous and notorious percentage of bond obligations in Chinese
yes.
hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually ditch those in favor of an independent reserve currency, which has been mooted, it's true, by the Chinese government, mm. is at the moment, and for pretty foreseeable future, an amazing case of cutting your nose to spite your face.
Yes.
If, in fact, such a move threatened to send the American economy into free fall, their export market, which is a serious percentage of their GDP, suffers proportionately, and that export market is based on manufacturers at which migrant workers, many of them coming from Western China, are employed or, as now is the case, unemployed. The basic overall picture is that, in a weird way, we're the odd couple, the Chinese and the United States.
And yet I've had them say to us on the air here, don't lean on us. Don't expect us to, you know, be your crutch forever, USA.
Who's saying that, Tom?
Well, we've got, we're borrowing from them and they know it. We need
It's a really interesting point that Simon makes when he talks about the odd couple. In The Ascent of Money, I used the word chimerica, mm-hmm. Which I've trademarked, which was really the symbiotic relationship between China and America in the period after the Asian crisis of 1997-98.
But that's ending, Chinese, you say.
Yeah, it is. I think that marriage is on the rocks. And marriages that are based on one partner doing all the saving and the other partner doing all the spending don't tend to last forever, do they?
Neil, Simon, lots of comments here. Let's see. From Facebook, we've got Rachel saying, I think we are headed toward a similar fate as post-World War II Great Britain or the Roman Empire. She sees global overreach, hubris, ballooning debt, eclipse of the financial sector, or the ascent of the financial sector over manufacturing. From the website, Gabrielle in Brooklyn says, Many Republicans and conservatives today take issue with President Obama's social agenda. He's often tarred as a socialist. What would our founding fathers think of his plans for narrowing the income gap in this country? What political philosophers did they look to? I'll put that to you, Simon and Tim, on the website. Are we where the UK was around the turn of the 20th century with its wars in Africa, its occupation of India, and its skewed income distribution, its shaky financial dominance? I'll let you stew on those and bring in a call from Los Angeles. Saad in California, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I'm actually watching Simon's History of Britain documentary, which is a collaboration between History Channel and BBC, and I'm really thoroughly enjoying it.
He's the king of all media.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And my question is, I actually believe this history does repeat itself, and Britain in general and Europe, and Britain in particular, and Europe in general has been the birthplace of capitalism. Yet if we look at Europe now, we see that socialism is everywhere. Everything is nationalized in Britain. Do they expect, and especially the question for Simon, does he expect that history is going to repeat itself? And for the next 200 to 300 years, little America, which is like, you know, the British experiment, is going to change from capitalism to a more socialist, nationalistic society.
Saad, thank you. Simon Sharma.
No, I don't really think history repeats itself in a kind of cloning, self-cloning way, you know. Certain things, certain patterns recur, which makes it illuminating sometimes to look at the way people responded, for example, in the years of the Great Depression. But I do actually rather share Neil's view that we are unlike, both in quantitative and qualitative sense, that particular economic crisis. I also actually share his view that Keynes isn't necessarily the answer, he may be surprised to hear. But I actually think in terms of actually understanding the nuances and particularities, really, whatever America evolves into, and it must do that, will be, I think, a distinctively American way. And I absolutely, the president has made it clear he doesn't think the government ought to be, in the long term, much less forever, in the banking business. So I think, again, rather in a way in which I was slightly being a little sniffy about the American tendencies to see only anguish or ecstasy as the available opportunity, the notion that it's either capitalism or something, you know, resembling the Soviet Union under Leonid Brezhnev.
But Europe, sadly,
sort of missed the point. Well, you know, it's true there's been an absolutely massive transfer of power from the private to the public sector in the world of finance in both the British and European, and some European countries, and in the American case. But that was simply a matter of emergency, much as, you know, a war mobilization requires a sudden exercise of strenuous public governmental muscle. It's a sort of dealing really with the crisis of the moment. Whether or not that congeals into a longer-term notion that public institutions rather than private entrepreneurial institutions will make the going in the economy is up for the people to decide. That's what a democracy does. It's up for Congress to sort of to debate, and up for an administration to set the alternatives before the American people.
And what about our Brooklyn Gabrielle's questions, kind of in your wheelhouse? We'll come to you right away, Neil. But she says, you know, what would our founding fathers think of Obama's plans for narrowing the income gap in this country, philosophically?
Well, of course, the income gap widened dramatically between the 1970s and now, with an overwhelming increase in the real incomes of the top 1%, and an even more extraordinary increase in the incomes of the 0.1%, and so on, with median income families barely experiencing any significant increase in their incomes. I don't think it's socialism to try and at least reverse some of that extraordinary widening of inequality. If you end up with, to use a rather technical term, a Gini coefficient, that's a measure of inequality that's closer to Brazil's than to, say, Denmark's, then prepare to be a Latin American economy in other ways too. And that,
those,
I think, is a very important point for the United States. Maybe we're looking in the wrong direction when we keep looking at Europe and saying, why can't, well, some people at least do say in New York, why can't America be more like Europe? Well, my question is, will the United States end up being a Latin American economy, and indeed a Latin American society, by the middle of the century? Because the demographic trends are there. as well as the economic trends and as well as the trends in terms of distribution. I think this socialism issue is a bit of a red herring, no pun intended, because, of course, this isn't really the option that anybody wants to exercise here. It's a temporary control or partial control, at least, of the big banks to prevent them from going bust. It looks like temporary intervention to wind down at least two out of the big three in Detroit. The redistribution certainly not going to turn the United States into Denmark. These are going to be really quite marginal changes. And I think the reason for that is that, and this has been true for over 100 years, culturally, and this may have to do with America's religious tradition, Americans are allergic to socialism. And not even the most left-of-center Democratic president in the history of the United States is going to turn this into a socialist country. That's not what Americans are hardwired for.
Let's go to Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm pretty optimistic about the future insofar as I think we're heading for a pretty big crash. And I think when things crash, exciting things can happen. So I think Obama's off to a pretty rocky start. I think his banking proposals won't work out. I'm hopeful that people will see them for what they are. I mean, I think it's been interesting to hear everybody's idea of what America is, you know, because underneath it, I'm always trying to listen for what the myth is. And for me, I think it's just the myth of a wide open field with, you know, plenty of room for everybody to make something of their lives. And when you take that myth and stack it up against the reality, I think more and more people are seeing that the cards are really stacked against them because of the way the power brokers run the system. And I think that will only come apart in the face of a great disaster.
But you say you're optimistic, Sam. What's the chick that hatches out of that bad-sounding egg?
It's the happy apocalypse.
Well,
I love it.
Well, I think what hatches out of that is the desire of people to make something good. I don't think people really want to make money. I don't know too many people that are really interested in that. If you really talk to people, they want to say, gee, I did that, and that's a good thing. So my optimism is based on people that I personally, personally, that's what people want. They want to make something good. I don't meet many people that want to make money. So I think when people begin to really see that where the country has taken a wrong turn, you know, because we're coming out of a very, very dark time the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, the war in Iraq was a direct replay of Vietnam. The things that are going on right now with these hearings about secrecy and what is, you know, it's a direct replay of what happened and was revealed under the Church Commission. You don't have to go very far.
Yeah.
You know, we're only going back 20 or 30 years now. You don't have to know great detail about American history.
Sam, that's a lot. Let us pick it up. Simon Sharma, given that...
There's such a lot there. Wow.
How elastic, I think, is the question I come to. How elastic the American tradition... Let's say there's a crisis. Sam says, right. Well, maybe something totally different will grow out of this, you know, than what we've known for decades anyway. What do you say?
Sam's is a great voice, I have to say. But when I lived next door, Lincoln, Massachusetts, there were plenty of people interested in making money.
Yes,
I remember
indeed.
Three-car garages
not
stretching all the way to Wellesley
and
beyond and Lexington, where I live. However, his is an absolutely authentic American voice when he says people want to make something and it's good. And I think there, my goodness, you know, Jefferson would have been very happy to have said that, and Franklin too as well. He said two things which seem to be in contradiction, but both very interesting in their ways. One, he said very airily, the banking proposals aren't going to work. Well, maybe in the best of all possible worlds, in the most wise of possible worlds, they might not. But there was one very practical thing to do in 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act, preventing commercial banks from behaving like investment banks, was repealed. And I'm not saying we should reinstate it. That would be, again, the problem of wanting to repeat history in a different place. But goodness, we all, I think, agree that part of the soup we're in was due to the fact that transparency disappeared when commercial banks did indeed start to trade in what turned out to be incredibly dodgy form of the security market. So just putting one particular piece of legislation in place can't do any harm. The larger point, though, which I love Sam making, was to say he thought the myth of America, which hasn't done us good and which is leading us to a kind of the illumination that disaster can bring, is the open field. And there I write about this a bit in the American Century in the chapter called American Plenty, particularly in relationship to our water resources, which is the next great climate crisis for the West. Hello, Albuquerque, we have no water in 20 years' time. And there is this mentality in American society of the entitlement, of what I call the entitlement to infinity. It's deep, hardwired into the stories that people like Benjamin Franklin told us about what it means to America. You work hard enough, you stick your hoe in the ground, you bung a drill in, and oil and abundance will come your way. There's always another bit of Alaska to sort of stick your hoe or your drill into. But the good news, I think, and maybe Sam will share this view, is that if we think, if we can't have that anymore, we've come to the end of the entitlement to infinity. What we can rely on, though, is the kind of lateral thought ingenuity that produced great search engines like Google, which, even if we don't like it forced upon us, which will produce technological innovations which lead us to live more sensibly and more prudently and a little bit more within our means. That's what is to be hoped for, I think.
But that's a kind of just transmuting of the myth, isn't it? It's another kind of wide-open field. It takes it off of the ecology, and in that case, into Internet. I mean,
Last time I looked, Google wasn't a myth.
Not at all, but it keeps the myth alive in another form. I mean, I think some Americans are looking for a way of redefining that myth, so it's not just about physical stuff, right, but the kind of elasticity and freedom to redefine in many dimensions.
Well, I would call that hope rather than myth.
Yeah, yeah, I'm all for it.
Look, the underlying driver of economic growth, and that is, after all, the basis for the power of the United States and its success as a society, is technological innovation. And it doesn't really matter whether you're drilling in the ground or building a search engine. You've got to have that going on. That was what failed in Britain, and we shouldn't lose sight of that. The basic decline in the UK growth rate was a function of falling productivity, and that reflected a complete breakdown of technological innovation. Now, as long as the United States is still the best place to innovate technologically and the best place to roll out new ideas as profit-making firms, i.e. the best place for entrepreneurs, then I think the US is okay. And this is the sense in which I am not Dr. Doom at all. In fact, I'm fundamentally still optimistic about the US because I still think that's true. The danger is that the kind of problems we've talked about earlier, the fiscal crisis that is clearly looming, that those problems could start to impede entrepreneurship and could start to impede technological innovation. You need, for example, high-quality immigrants to keep the technological show on the road. Google was not invented by native-born Americans, and that is itself significant. The US still has the best universities in the world. That's why we're here.
Yeah, hello.
It's no coincidence.
It is an educational point.
And education is absolutely crucial to another part of the American dream, which was touched on actually a minute ago, but not sufficiently elaborated on. The big American dream is social mobility. You know, wherever you start, you can get to the top. And that dream is very widely believed in, except that the dream is fading. Social mobility has declined steeply since the 1950s and 1960s. You're much more likely to stay in the bottom quintile of the distribution, the one that you were born into, than you were back in the 50s, back in the post-war era. That means that the dream is at variance with reality in a way that hasn't been true for half a century.
Yeah, but that's why the president is such an emblematic figure, really, because actually he came from a background that was, he writes very movingly about in Dreams of My Father, the shiftless, rootless, difficult, often commercially incompetent grandfather, the hippie mother who turned into an incarnation of Benjamin Franklin, getting him up at 4 o'clock in the morning in Jakarta and so on. The president, who's deeply impassioned, and Michelle, you have to say as well, authentically working class, South Chicago family, the Robinsons, both of whom's lives have been transformed by education. Right. Yeah. So that horribly empty, shallow phrase, an educational presidency, if it has any chance of making any difference and sustaining the genius of innovation, it's for them. And I would also say that some of the people who feature in his government, Ken Salazar, for example, comes from a Hispanic culture, very successful junior senator in Colorado, now in a government, from the culture which we think is sort of impermeable, really, to American education-driven upward mobility, who represents the refutation of pessimism about that.
Simon, Neil points to tech innovation, entrepreneurship as a critical factor. When you look at this future, and our time is short now, but what do you think will make the difference between, we're going to evolve somehow, what will make the difference between a good evolution for this country and a bad one?
I find myself in the dispiriting position of having to echo my friend, actually. He's absolutely right. I don't actually have
bad
anything.
Bad day at the office.
A really bad day at the office. I don't have anything to add to his eloquence. That is it. In the long term, it is important that things like the healthcare system actually are embraced pragmatically for the preemptive limitation of debt damage and entitlement damage and so on. But the constructive part really is America as a leader in educational conceptual innovation. That all of the founding fathers who were busy with their libraries and their if you think about Franklin's touching 18th century faith in the transformational possibility of technology, of innovation, that may be, in fact, the American way.
Tom Simon's book is absolutely wonderful, and it's a wonderful evocation of
Jack Kerouac Redux, you say in your review.
I think it's one of the most brilliantly written books I think that's been published in many, many years. But there's one problem, and that is the title, because there's no such thing as the future, singular. There are American futures, plural. And what's fascinating about this time of crisis is that we all collectively get to choose what that future is going to be. One future is clearly imperial decline and fall. There's no question that that's an option. But another future is recovery, is a bounce back of the sort, of course, that came after the Great Depression.
But, dear friend, if I'd have called it American Futures, people would have thought it was pork bellies and would have rushed out. No one's buying pork bellies because of swine flu.
You'd have sold so many copies in Chicago.
Simon Shamet, you asked at the top what our theme is. Of all things, it's Fortet, British musician, Kiernan Hebden, and it's Everything Is All Right. But we're not going out on that today. We're going out on a different theme, maybe in a whole new direction. Simon Shamet, author of The American Future of History, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been great. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Neil Ferguson, author of War of the World, Colossus, Empire, and the Ascent of Money. Wonderful to have you with us as well. Professor Ferguson, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, still the one. This is On Point.